This episode of Crosscut Talks is supported by Alaska Airlines.
Hey, welcome to Crosscut Talks. I'm Mark Baumgarten, the managing editor at Crosscut. Safety as a concept is easy enough to grasp. Everybody wants to feel safe from sickness, from harm, from want. But what happens when one person's safety or self-preservation requires someone else to sacrifice their safety? That's when things get a little less easy, and that is where we are right now. Workers are being asked to return to jobs that carry a risk of illness or death so that the economy can carry on. There is an assessment being made here, and while the COVID-19 pandemic is forcing that assessment to play out for the world to see, some version of these difficult decisions has always been with us. Risk is unavoidable. The hope is that we have good information that will help us make a good decision, one that takes into account everyone's safety and security and that distributes the risk and sacrifice. Of course, that's not always what happens. This week on Crosscut Talks, I'm talking to David Michaels, a former head of the Occupational Health and Safety Administration and the author of The Triumph of Doubt, Dark Money and the Science of Deception. In his book, Michaels details many of the tactics that corporations use to cast doubt on science that seeks to illuminate the potential harm posed by a product: tobacco, opioids, diesel, baby powder. The aim, says Michaels, is corporate self-preservation. The result, he says, is dysfunction in the way that the government protects workers and consumers. The distrust towards science and expertise that is shaping the federal government's response to the novel coronavirus, that, he says, owes a debt to these corporate campaigns. Before we get to David Michaels, though, I'm going to check in with Crosscut reporter David Croman about a very big project in the city of Seattle that is in very big trouble. But before we get to that, I wanted to let you know about a live event we have coming up. A Crosscut Talks virtual session with Washington State Governor Jay Inslee. Governor Inslee will be talking with Crosscut News and Politics editor Donna Blankenship about the state's handling of the pandemic. The event takes place on Tuesday, June 2nd at 11 a.m. For more information and to RSVP, go to crosscut.com/events. Okay, on with the show. I've got David Croman here. Crosscut recently published a report from David on the Washington State Convention Center expansion, a major construction project in downtown Seattle that the COVID-19 pandemic has thrown into limbo. David, welcome to Crosscut Talks.
Hello.
Hello. So you write that this convention center expansion is among the largest projects in Seattle history. Exactly how big is it?
It is, at least right now, going to be a $1.8 billion project, which in pure dollar terms is more than the construction of Safeco Field, CenturyLink Field, and the redevelopment of Key Arena combined, not adjusted for inflation. But it's also it's going to be 1.5 million square feet. So this is like truly, I don't know exactly how to fact check this, but it is considered perhaps the largest public works project in Washington state history.
Wow. And when did it begin?
They broke ground on it in the summer of 2018, although they have been planning this, of course, for a lot longer than that.
Okay. So according to your report, it's at risk of running out of money in 10 to 12 months. Why is that?
So you kind of have to get into some like wonky financing stuff. But basically, when they first started building it, the most they could get through a bond measure was about $1.1 billion. And of course, they needed more than that to finish it. Their plan was they were going to take out this first round of bonds. And then a little bit further down the road, they were going to take out another round, like another couple rounds, actually. Because when you take out a bond, basically, you have to have some sort of dedicated revenue source that you're going to pay those bonds back, sort of like a credit card. And so they were saying that we're going to take out these new bonds to finish this project. And the way we're going to pay it back is through taxes on hotels, motels, and Airbnbs. Of course, now nobody is staying in hotels, motels, or Airbnbs. And so basically their central promise that they can pay these loans back is no longer there. And so that means you know, that makes gives them a difficult case to take out a bond. But even more importantly, there's not going to be anybody who's really going to want to buy these bonds off of them. Basically, completely removing this last, they're saying it's about $300 million that they need to finish this project. So the cash they have on hand is going to last them another 10 to 12 months. But at that point, they would, you know, maybe be about 60% done with the project and not have any money left.
Huh. If this project comes to a grinding halt, what would the impact be in terms of jobs and then also just on downtown Seattle?
Yeah, the impact would there it would be fairly enormous on a lot of levels. So, I mean, for one, there's just the number of people that they need to work on this project. They're saying over the course of the entire construction, it'd be about 6,000 different people that are going to work on this. By this time next year, they were sort of forecasting that they would have 1,000 people working on the project at a single at a given moment. So that's 1,000 people who would be out of a job, which, you know, in this climate sounds like not that much relative to the enormous job losses we've seen. But, you know, before this pandemic, 1,000 people being out of work would be fairly substantial. And then, of course, you know, there would be this partially completed project just sitting there. And for anybody who's driven down I-5 or gone on Boren, you can see that it's pretty far along. I mean, this is a large project already at 30% done.
Yeah.
And then, you know, for downtown, a lot of the businesses down there have been struggling lately as they compete both with sort of internet business, but also shopping centers in Bellevue and in the university district. The focus has just not been on downtown like it used to be. And so
right, you're talking even prior to the outbreak,
right?
That this is just the situation that existed anyway.
Yeah, exactly. Prior to the outbreak. And so a lot of those businesses were kind of hanging on, expecting that with this new convention center, there would be a pretty significant uptick in traffic. And, you know, already they had been seeing that. I mean, more and more of their business was coming from people who were traveling in from out of town or tourists and less from people who live here. Mm. So if the convention center doesn't go through, then this sort of final lifeline for a lot of businesses that, you know, were frankly already struggling even before the coronavirus would be pulled away.
Wow. Is Seattle the only place that this is happening? I mean, I imagine that there are other major projects like this that are grinding to a halt across the nation. Do you have a sense of where else this is going on?
I don't. I mean, Seattle is in this sort of particularly tricky situation because I think we're a little too early in this pandemic to see widespread defaults on existing debt, which isn't the problem at the convention center. They can pay the debt, at least for now, they can pay the debt that they owe. Their problem was they needed more money that they hadn't secured. So the Washington State Convention Center is in this like pretty unique situation where they're halfway done with a project that's not fully funded. And so I can't think of that. There's not that many other projects that are in that sort of tight of a spot. That said, a lot of convention centers and hotel projects and things like that are being built on bonds that are backed by that same sort of revenue source based on taxes from hotels and motels and things like that. So I think in the next few months, unless we have a vaccine or this thing really turns around, what we will start to see are more and more defaults, which means these projects can't pay back the money that they have already taken out.
Wow. So, but for this project, it just sounds like this is an immense project that was built on a lot of the confidence that came from the economic boom in Seattle. Mm-hmm. And because of the scope of it, it's in this unique position. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, if building something based off of the success of hotels and motels can be a risky strategy, but if there was anywhere almost on the planet where that was not considered a risky strategy, it was Seattle, because the hotel motel industry was growing by leaps and bounds. It was projected to keep growing at a sort of steady, at the very minimum, 4% every year. They're adding hundreds of hotel rooms every year. So even in sort of slight economic dips, nobody was really expecting that you would see some kind of bottom fallout of the hospitality industry in Seattle. In some ways, sort of the only thing that could have done that is something like what we are going through right now.
Wow. So you said, you know, if there's a vaccine, if this thing ends pretty soon, that could solve the problem. Is there a way to right the ship even if the crisis extends into 2021 and beyond? What would it take to right the ship?
In the short term, it would take about $300 million. That's obviously a big question where they get that. Their hopes are in the federal government passing another round of economic aid. The first couple packages didn't include anything for large-scale infrastructure projects like the convention center. So they would need another package to include that. That is a little bit of a long shot right now because Mitch McConnell has not shown a willingness to do that, even if the Democrats in the House have. That's their sort of best hope, even if it is not a great hope. You know, they could look for other philanthropy, find somebody who could give them some kind of bridge loan that they don't have to pay back for another 4 to 8 years, or basically stretch their credit rating so that they could find an investor to buy these bonds, although that would probably give them really unfavorable rates and probably send them around, down a road that they wouldn't want to go down. So it really comes down to the federal government, at least for the short term. The long term, though, is a bigger question mark, because the reason they were building this convention center is because demand for conventions and demand for hotels appeared like it was just going to be growing forever.
Right.
So the other question is, even if they get this $300 million and they finish this thing, is it going to do what they wanted it to do? Are people going to ever be willing to sit in super tight spaces for days on end at a conference in a city like Seattle? I don't know. That's a question mark.
All right. Well, David, thanks so much for your work and thanks for coming on the show.
Thanks for having me.
And now for a word from our sponsor, Alaska Airlines. Alaska is taking care to the next level with a renewed commitment to providing a higher standard of cleanliness and safety. From airport check-in to boarding, from takeoff to landing, Next Level Care involves COVID-19 preparedness plans and procedures developed with the FAA and CDC. This includes electrostatic disinfectant sprayers and onboard filters that remove 99.95% of airborne particles. Alaska is also putting proper social distancing procedures in place, requiring masks of employees and guests, providing sanitizing stations and wipes, reconfiguring seating arrangements, limiting in-flight services, and more. When you decide it's time to fly, Alaska is prepared to take your travels to the next level. Learn more at alaskaair.com/nextlevelcare. Welcome back to Crosscut Talks. I'm speaking now with David Michaels. David is the author of The Triumph of Doubt: Dark Money and the Science of Deception. He is also the former head of the Occupational Safety and Health Administration under President Obama, and currently works as a professor at George Washington University. David, welcome to Crosscut Talks.
Mark, thank you for inviting me on the show.
So I'm not your first audience this morning. I understand you were at a congressional briefing just now. What were you talking about?
A number of members from the tri-state area, New York, New Jersey, Connecticut, thinking about how to reopen the economy safely. It was a bipartisan group, and they really asked me, you know, how do we open the economy? How do we make sure workers are safe when we do that? And I've been spending a lot of my time on that very question for the last 2 or 3 months.
So by way of kind of biography, why don't you tell the listeners exactly why you're the person that they were calling on?
Well, the first is I'm an epidemiologist. You know, up until a few months ago, when you went to a party, if you ever did go to a party, you'd have to tell people what epidemiologists are and what they do. That's no longer of great concern. Everybody knows what an epidemiologist is. And my focus was on worker safety. And I ran the Occupational Safety and Health Administration for more than 7 years. I was the longest serving head of OSHA in the agency's history. And so those two things are sort of like the daily double. I mean, right now we have to think about worker safety and what the government should do to make sure workers are safe from an epidemiologic perspective. So I get a lot of phone calls and I'm asked to help figure out how do we do this right. And it's challenging because right now there is no way to do it right, absolutely right, because we don't know enough about the disease and we don't have good testing. We can't be sure if people are infectious or not. And so if we want to reopen business, it requires taking some risks, and that those are risks that are being inflicted on workers. And so how we do that is a really important question.
Like you said, epidemiology is having a bit of a moment right now. When did you realize that you wanted to work in this field?
You know, I was a history major undergraduate at City College of New York, and I actually got a job working at a hospital in the Bronx looking at prison health issues. Prisoners are the only people in the United States with the constitutional right to health care. And this hospital ran the prison healthcare system at Rikers Island. I was just helping out essentially as a research assistant. I knew someone who got me the job. And someone gave me a great book called Causal Thinking in the Health Sciences. It sounds dry, but it was written by a South African physician who was very close to Nelson Mandela. He was a white physician who in the 1950s and 60s saw that if you had a population of literally hundreds of thousands of Africans with a few physicians, primary care is irrelevant. You have to think about population science. And so he wrote that he became an epidemiologist and wrote a brilliant book about how to think about causation. And I read this book by Mervyn Susser, and I said, this is what I want to do for my life. You know, after doing research for quite a long time and turning out a lot of important studies, I think, I was asked by President Clinton to become the chief safety officer for the nuclear weapons complex. The position was Assistant Secretary of Energy for Environment, Safety, and Health. And that's the job to make sure that people who work in our big nuclear facilities like Hanford in Washington State or Los Alamos or Oak Ridge, the people who work in those places or who live near those places or the environment are safe. And those are quite dangerous places. And I had a great run. I went back into academia during the George W. Bush presidency, and then President Obama asked me to come back and run OSHA.
What do people not understand about epidemiology? I mean, we all are now amateur epidemiologists, right? What don't we understand about the actual field of epidemiology?
You know, epidemiology is in some ways, it's a probabilistic science. You never get the exact result, you never get something that's absolutely certain, but you make a probabilistic statement. So, for example, if we're interested in talking about asbestos and lung cancer, we know that people who are exposed to asbestos are at increased risk of lung cancer, and we have studies on that. Do we know if the risk is doubled or tripled or quadrupled? We don't really know that. And for any one individual, epidemiology doesn't tell us, did they get lung cancer because they were exposed to asbestos? We just know that their risk increased. And if they were exposed to a lot of it, it's more likely than not that it was caused by it. And you could attempt to figure out a percentage. But from the bigger point of view, the policy point of view, you look at epidemiology and you say, you know, epidemiology tells us that there's a relationship between this exposure and this outcome. We're not going to understand the relationship perfectly, but epidemiology tells us that at the moment, here's the best available evidence we have, and therefore it's incumbent upon us to use that evidence. And that's what drew me to epidemiology. It sort of describes the world and it gives you a path forward. It says, if we know people are being exposed and we think, because of all these studies, that the risk of this disease is being is elevated because people have been exposed, we can't wait for more studies. You know, you take the epidemiology and you say, okay, let's apply that. We may be wrong some of the time. Most of the time we'll be right, but it's okay to be wrong sometimes if we're going to be right more often than not, and we're going to make sure people are safe as a result of that.
If you were still the head of OSHA, how would you be responding to the COVID crisis right now?
Oh, that is a great question. I mean, the first thing I would do, and I would do this, you know, 10 minutes into the job, is to issue an emergency standard and say that every employer in the United States has to make a plan. If you want to open your doors right now, you have to know how you're going to be protecting your employees, and you've got to implement that plan. Right now, OSHA doesn't have a standard for airborne infections. It only has one for bloodborne. During the Obama administration, we actually were working on a new standard for airborne infections. But when the Trump administration came in, they stopped all work on that. It would be out by now, and it would be playing a role in protecting workers. A standard's not enough, but it would have had a big impact. Right now, every employer should know that they have to make sure workers are protected. The law says employers have to provide a workplace free of recognized hazards, and the biggest recognized serious hazard right now is COVID-19.
So what is OSHA doing right now?
You know, it's not doing enough. It's issuing some recommendations, which are useful. But it's not leaning hard into this and saying to every employer, you must do the right thing. Even if we can't inspect you, this is what your obligation is. OSHA is not leaning into the problem. It's getting thousands of complaints. It needs to tell employers across the country that they need to make sure workers are safe. And actually, it probably has to come from above OSHA. It has to come from the president. It has to come from governors, because everybody's got to be involved in this. OSHA is a small agency. They've got enough people to visit in good times every workplace once every 165 years, and these are not good times. It needs to issue a standard and say it's the law that you have to start protecting workers and be very high profile about it.
I want to come back to the federal response to the outbreak in a bit, but first I want us to talk a little bit about your book, because I think it'll be really instructive for us to talk about the things that were going on before the coronavirus outbreak to really understand how the federal government is responding now. So the main aim of your book is really to lay out a fairly systematic process wherein corporations hire so-called product defense firms to manufacture doubt. Right?
That's exactly right.
You write that, quote, in the product defense model, the investigator starts with an answer, then figures out the best way to support it. So what are some of the ways that they do that?
Well, it's a whole range of different types of things that look scientific. I mean, that's part of the trick here. First of all, you've got this industry that people don't even know exists. There are a bunch of firms that their business model is to produce materials for their client that will stop the government from issuing a regulation, or they could take it to court to win a court case. And so you create things that look like science. For example, you could do what you'll call a literature review or a weight of the evidence analysis. And you look at all the studies and you say, our conclusion is that either this chemical doesn't cause this outcome, this disease, or only at very high levels are we sure that it causes illness, because the studies showing that it causes illness at low levels are just not very good. That's one set of studies that they'll produce. Or another one, which is really sort of the epidemiologist's dream or nightmare, is a corporation will get the raw data from a study done by a university scientist or by a government scientist. And the law, which was passed really at the behest of the tobacco industry, requires you, if you got federal funding, to give up your raw data. And then what these product defense scientists will do is they will reanalyze the raw data and make the result go away. So it looks like you have two equal and opposite studies. Well, the second study isn't an equal study. It's not difficult to take a positive study, and if you know exactly how to change some of the assumptions and some of the parameters, to turn it into something that's negative or just inconclusive. And then that gets published in a journal that's controlled by these same really mercenary scientists. And it goes through peer review because their peers review it. And all of a sudden, you know, that goes into the docket of the Environmental Protection Agency or the Occupational Safety and Health Administration. And you say, look, this study says the opposite of where you're going. And that slows an agency down. And then they have to refute that study because the laws are written that the agencies have to respond to every comment, to every study that comes in. And then, of course, all of these firms are connected to public relations firms who will take the studies done by these product defense scientists and elevate them, get them on TV, get them into newspapers. And so it looks like for every article that's published or for every interview on TV, there's someone from the industry saying, well, the science isn't there, or the science shows that it's safe. It's a playbook. We call it the tobacco playbook because tobacco did so carefully and so well for so long. But now it's used extremely widely and successfully.
You know, you mentioned this, but one of the more troubling practices that you cite for me, or what I thought was the most troubling, was that these mercenary scientists, as you call them, place industry-funded and sometimes corrupted studies in peer-reviewed journals. I have no idea how I would go about discerning a valid study from an invalid study, or even a journal that should be paid attention to and one that should be discarded. Is there a way that sort of the layperson can discern between these things?
You know, it's really tough. I mean, one thing I tell people who really want to get into this and dig deep, you could look at and see what the record is of any one of these scientists. You know, you can search what else, who else have they worked for? What else have they done? I always look in the tobacco archives. You know, because of the litigation against the tobacco industry, there are millions of pages of tobacco documents. And when I see a study by some scientists I haven't heard of, the first thing I do is look to see if they were working for tobacco. Now, that's not proof that they were corrupt, but it's one more indication.
You write in your book, you quote Upton Sinclair. You say, "It is difficult to convince a man of something if his salary depends on him not believing it." And you talk about this phenomenon, motivated reasoning. You entertain the idea that some of the scientists and researchers you're talking about, and epidemiologists like you, maybe believe in the science they're doing.
I have to think that the folks who are working for these companies claiming these dangerous exposures are safe are not just doing it for money, that they must believe it, because it would be worse if they were just doing it for money. And I like to think more of sort of the human condition, that they're not saying, here's a chemical that I know causes cancer, but I'm really going to say it's safe and let people be exposed to it. I think they convince themselves, because there's a lot of money involved, and these people you can make millions of dollars a year.
Are you seeing any evidence that product defense tactics are being utilized by corporations right now during the outbreak?
No. What I'm seeing, though, in relationship to the book is really the response by President Trump, the White House, and at the beginning, some of his Republican cronies and Fox News, that looking at the reports by public health scientists that we had a potential crisis before we had this major crisis in the United States with tens of thousands of people dying. But when the first cases were coming out, and many of us were saying, you know, we've seen this before, this is a potentially huge problem. We need to work quickly to deal with it. President Trump and Fox News responded to this the same way they respond to scientists around climate change, for example, and all these other things. And that's really because they've been sort of programmed to do this. They're sort of an anti-science, anti-intellectual fervor in Trump, and now he controls the Republican Party and his people. And so when you hear from a scientist who says, you know, I look at the numbers, it's epidemiology, we don't have the hard cases in front of us, but we can see what's going on, and we think it's very likely that this will happen, they said, oh, that's ridiculous. I think that's driven by the tobacco industry and by the oil industry, that the tobacco industry put a lot of money into these free market liberty think tanks and advocacy groups that got the Tea Party going. The Tea Party was funded by some of the tobacco companies at the very beginning. And it was this idea that the government shouldn't step in and they don't need to regulate, they don't need to tell people what to do. But part of doing that has to be to downplay the risk, because if the risk is serious, then the government really does have to step in. And so the tobacco industry do that, and then the Koch brothers start doing that very heavily with the Republican Party in the 90s and the early 2000s. That really became dogma. If you didn't buy into that, you weren't a true member of the Republican Party. And so that really developed to this wild sort of anti-intellectualism.
So it appears that what you're talking about is that there is a playbook for corporations to work with the Republican Party in order to kind of pull back regulation or prevent regulation when there is risk to workers. And right now, we are in a moment where there is a new risk. It is a very dramatic situation, and that there is a playbook still for how to approach risk. And I wonder, is the federal government still using that playbook? And if so, was there any point at which it seemed like they might not use that playbook?
Well, I think early in the pandemic, they pulled out a couple of these lines saying, oh, it's just these quack scientists, things like that. It's a hoax. Once it became real, they had to address it. But even now, they sort of downplay the risk. There's a lot of discussion about in workplaces, for example, saying that the risk doesn't come from the workplace. It's really remarkable to see this when you look at, say, the meatpacking plants, where you've got hundreds, in some cases more than 1,000 workers infected at any one plant. But we saw that the governor of South Dakota announced that the exposures that we're seeing among meatpacking workers at the Smithfield plant in Sioux Falls, South Dakota, were really happening at home. And it was really, that was very poorly disguised racism, I think. Most of those workers are immigrants. The pork industry used to hire a lot of undocumented workers, but after the government cracked down on them, they worked very hard to attract refugees, often settled by the State Department from Somalia, from Bhutan, from all over the world. And they would settle in South Dakota and they worked there, but they're, you know, they're not white. And the folks in charge in South Dakota are white. And they said, oh, it must be what's going on in their homes, not going on these plants. Though, in fact, every one of these meatpacking plants that we've looked at, we see very high transmission rates. Even HHS, the Secretary of HHS, has made statements that suggest that it's really just exposures at home that are resulting in these exposures. So it's shift, and that's what tobacco would always do. They'd say it wasn't the cigarettes that's causing lung cancer, it's really something else.
So I just have one more question for you. It's really about, I guess, your perspective on the whole ball of wax here. And, you know, the title of your book is The Triumph of Doubt. But in almost every one of the case studies you cite throughout the book, and there are a number of them, real science kind of wins out, or at least the bunk science is outed as what it is. So is doubt really winning, or does truth just take some time to win?
Well, I think truth often in the long run wins, but a lot of people are hurt along the way. And of course, the stories I'm telling are ones where the facts came out, because I can tell the story. I think there are a lot of examples where we don't really know what happened and the truth did not win out. We're not there on climate change. I mean, the truth is pretty obvious, but we are heading for a disaster unless we do something about it. But I am an optimist, and I think that we have to look at what Donald Trump is doing to our regulatory system, even, and this was true before COVID-19, but certainly true now, by damaging it so badly, by defunding it, by having a lot of the best people leave and rolling back regulation. He's given us an opportunity. We desperately need to rebuild our system of public health protections and our public health infrastructure. And there's no one in the United States who doesn't understand that now. They may not have understood 4 months ago, but our public health infrastructure wasn't working before COVID-19, that the EPA has great difficulty regulating toxic chemicals. It still works on this concept of one chemical at a time. And look, we've got these PFAS chemicals, these forever chemicals, where we have, you know, 4,000 or 5,000 different chemicals, and we have human data on two of them. Are we going to wait to see more people get sick before we regulate the third and the fourth and the fifth? And what happens to the 500th or the 5,000th? So we have to look at things differently. We have to put different responsibilities on corporations. Look at, you know, Boeing has gone through this terrible crisis because of the 737 MAX jet. And a lot of that is because the FAA outsourced safety to Boeing. And and that wasn't a decision by President Trump. And that was done under Democratic and Republican administrations because we didn't fund the FAA and they didn't have the resources or the expertise to oversee that safety. The best engineers didn't really want to work for government salaries. And I understand that. So we have to rethink how we protect the public. And I think what Donald Trump has done to our regulatory system and what COVID-19 has continued gives us this opportunity. Once we're out of this mess, we have to relook at this differently and learn from those mistakes and think about how we have to make sure that only good science prevails in these cases.
All right. Well, David Michaels, thank you so much for coming on Crosscut Talks. Really appreciate it.
Well, thanks, Mark. This was enjoyable for me, too.
Thanks for listening to Crosscut Talks. This week's episode was engineered by Resty Bacall and produced by Jake Newman. You can subscribe to Crosscut Talks on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, or wherever you listen. For more on the Crosscut Talks podcast, go to crosscut.com/talks. And if you like the show, please review us. It really helps other people find us. For the latest political, environmental, and culture news from the Pacific Northwest, visit crosscut.com. Crosscut Talks is a product of Cascade Public Media. I'm Mark Bumgarten. We'll be back next week with another episode.